Am I Joanne? And but this year I thought, well, we have to absolutely make sure that we reach 4,000 as well. So to make sure we reach that magic 4,000 figure, we have brought up some Florida voter registration experts. So you may see a few people wander around with three name tags. You know, that's quite all right. I'm extremely happy, and we're going to make sure that we get in right to the meat of the morning quite quickly because we know people have sessions at 9 o'clock. I'm extremely excited this morning. When I heard that Craig Kyleberger was going to be coming, I thought, you know, that's something worth getting up and being there at 8 o'clock in the morning for us. So, and obviously you all feel exactly the same way. I can remember when, very easily, when Craig broke onto the scene as the very young Oakville youth, who it was fun to watch him as he stalked almost prime ministers and world leaders and would take them aside and ask very simple and very pointed questions. And it was fun to watch him grow up and mature and to watch the sense of the enormous charisma and ability to speak that this young fellow has. We do have some more recent announcements, and I'm sure that you've all read his bio and can see that. Just last week, Oprah announced that his Save the Children Fund would be the tsunami relief effort of choice for Oprah and for her show, and she was directing people to send their donations in that particular direction. I mean, that's quite an amazing accomplishment. He does have his new book out, which is Me to We, or We to Me to We, and it's right here, and there are copies of it that will be outside. And it is now number 3 on the national bestseller list. It is with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce to you Craig Kyleberger. I'm not him. He gave me one job, and I didn't do it.
When you first see him, you might think he's just some ordinary kid, but 16-year-old Craig Kyleberger is anything but ordinary. When you first see him, you might think he's just some ordinary kid, but 16-year-old Craig Kyleberger is anything but ordinary. He has met with some of the most important political and religious leaders of our time, and his life's mission is to fight against child labor and slavery. We thought that made him pretty extraordinary. Well, it turns out others agreed.
Countries like India, where we provide children with an education in order to prevent them from ending up exploited into child labor. To dozens of other countries around the world where we have worked in partnership with the local community, funding and supporting schools in some of the poorest regions on earth. And schools are just the beginning. We bring clean water projects, medical clinics, and alternative sources of income to help empower communities and women so that children do not have to be sent to work in situations of child labor, and instead can be sent to school to receive a brighter future and learn how to read, write, and are given the chance to break the cycle of poverty. Time and time again, our organization has spoken out for children's rights and proved that change is possible. Here in North America, we empower young people with a sense of global citizenship, the realization that they can make a difference in our world through our leadership, empowerment, camps, conferences, and volunteer opportunities to developing countries. Young people are given the tools and skills so that they can make a difference.
Good morning. Say it again. Good morning. Okay, there you go. I want to say thank you very much to Ken for the wonderful introduction, but even more importantly for getting his whole family involved. You'll be hearing from them a little later on about what they've been getting involved with for research projects. But thank you again, and thank you to all the organizers. But most importantly, thank you to all of you for coming out here at 8 in the morning. I don't know about you, but considering we help run a youth organization, we don't start our conferences until 10. That's the opening session. 11, most of us start arriving, you know, but we go until 11 p.m. at night, so it kind of balances out. But at Free the Children, we have a tradition because we, you know, have a little hard time rolling out of bed in the morning. We're young people. A little something we like to do to get the blood flowing. It's a little wake-up exercise. And I know some of you are probably thinking, oh man, should have stayed in bed, extra hour of sleep. No, it actually, it has a point to it. It has a moral, it has a lesson, and we'll come to that. It's a little unorthodox, and that's my warning. But again, we're young people. And to make this happen, specifically we need a volunteer. But we need a very particular type of volunteer. We need a volunteer who's celebrating his or her birthday this week. This is when people are like to your friends, no, don't point me out. Yes. Good morning. You seem amazingly awake. Absolutely. How you doing, Jenny? Jeannie, pardon me, Jeannie. This is Jeannie, everyone. Do you want to do a quick welcome here? So now, in our organization, Free the Children, with our young people, we have a bit of tradition. When someone celebrates his or her birthday, there's a little song that we sing in our organization. You might actually know it. Take a wild guess with me here. Absolutely. Happy birthday. No, we're going to sing Gigi happy birthday on her... Really?
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Wow, I was like 21, 22. Birthday. No, her 38th birthday. That's what she just mentioned. And everyone's, now Gigi's like, I shouldn't have walked up on stage. No, singing happy birthday, 38! This is something to celebrate this week. So we're going to ask you, on the count of three, if you could just, you know, give us a rendition here, happy birthday. 1, 2, 3. Jeannie, I got a question for you here.
Okay.
Okay. You should imagine ahead into the future of this here.
Okay.
Okay. When you're celebrating your 138th birthday.
Oh, boy.
Science is going this way. Totally possible. We'll reach this eventually. Okay, so you're sitting there, and you know, you're on your rocking chair, and you've got your... Do you have any children?
Yes.
No, okay. So future children and grandchildren, and by that time, probably great-grandchildren. And they're all sitting around, and they're like, great-great-grandmother, Jeannie, tell us that story. That story of how you managed in your 138 years to end all illiteracy in the world, to find a cure for cancer, and to stop our war.
That would be impressive.
That would be impressive. You're pretty busy in those 100 years. And Jeannie can sit there and she can say, well, kids, grandkids, you've heard the story, but I'll tell you again. It all started at this conference. It was really early at this conference, and I was with a group of my peers, a group of librarians, and I saw in them, while they were singing happy birthday, so much energy and so much passion But I just looked at it, this ocean of people, and I said to myself, if we can capture that energy and capture that passion and channel it for positive causes, if we can get people excited about reading, if we can get people excited about making a difference to the world, if we can just take all that energy and bottle it and bring it back, we can do anything. Okay. Now, based on that rendition of Happy Birthday you just heard,
yeah,
do you think you're going to be telling your great-great-grandchildren 138, you know, that was what happened?
Well,
probably not.
It is early.
It is early. We know it's early, but I got to ask you a question. So do you think people can really change the world,
yes,
really change the world with their arms crossed and all the negative body language? Absolutely not. You're going to unfold those arms. Yes. Do you think people can change the world sitting down?
No.
Absolutely not. We need you to stand up, please. Okay, now I've got a question for you. Whose birthday is it? Okay, I hear you. Whose birthday is it? Okay, we're moving a little bit more with the two people here. I still can hear you. We live in a society of neck ups. You only function from like the neck up. We'll talk, we might even smile. We have the rest of our body. Whose birthday is it? Nice! Absolutely! Yeah, your personal cheering squad right there. Hey, you know that myth of librarians being quiet? We're going to disprove that this morning. So we got the hand motion. We know, and it's complicated. It's a little hip motion. You got to like leave points and Jeannie's birthday. We got that. We want to get the sound. Really, this is the one time where no one's going to say, shh. We need you to cough in your lungs. We need to run this to Happy Birthday. The other people are going to be like, who's going in that conference? Librarians? What? We want to disprove this myth. Okay, so with that level of energy and enthusiasm, as loud as you can, with the hands, we want to give Jenny a rendition of Happy Birthday she will never forget.
I
want to
dance.
Absolutely. So on the count of three, with all your passion and all your energy, 1, 2, 3. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. So why do we do that? Thank you. It's 8 in the morning. I'll be honest. That was one of the reasons, and I still see a lot of coffee from people's hands. It was another reason. How many times in your life do you think you've sung happy birthday? Lots. Millions. Wow, someone's got a lot of friends. Millions! We sing it the same way every time. We sing it the same way the person next to us sings it. The same way the person behind us, the same way the person in front of us. Happy birthday to you. We forget the word happy. It's kind of expected. It becomes a routine. Just like how we wake up in the morning, roll out of bed, grumble a hello, get in our cars, honk the horn, get to work, sit behind the desk, or get to school and sit in the lecture hall. The question is how we stop a routine. How do you take something ordinary, as ordinary as Happy Birthday, something we've sung a million times, and make it extraordinary? How do we get people excited about reading? How do you get students who want to get up in the morning, even at 8 in the morning, and come to a conference? I heard some students actually came here today. Don't see many of them, but I hear that there's some amongst us. Can you be able to rouse them out of bed? Sorry? They'll be here by 10. How do we get students excited to come into libraries? And as librarians, how do we take it to that next level? There's a great quote, one of my favorite, Nellie McClung. Amazing woman. I know librarians, but I don't need to tell you who she is, but Famous Five, Alberta Five, fought for the right of women to be declared people in Canada. That's the human rights struggle we have to fight for. She said, it is so much easier to sit down and to be resigned than to stand up and to be indignant. It is so much easier to sit down and be resigned than to stand up and to be indignant. And for those of you who are librarians in school, for those of you who work with young people, those of you who work in communities, those of you who reach out to people, how do we get people, when they walk into a library, not just to learn about information, but to become so passionate about what they learn that they physically get out of their seats, they stand up for what they believe in, they raise their voice, they get involved, they take action? That's what I want to talk about today. Because libraries have played a very special role in my life. In many ways, I'm here because of libraries, strangely enough. Ken shared with you a little bit about Free the Children, books, projects, what we do. Got involved in Free the Children when I was 12. That actually wasn't my first involvement in social activism. Got involved a year earlier. First ever campaign. I was 11. First time I learned about community activism. It was a campaign to save our local library from being closed. I grew up in Thornhill, a little bit north of here in Toronto, city of Vaughan. Any of you have probably heard of the Gallinau Public Library? I was in your neighborhood! That was me! We were 11. First time. Heard that they were closing Gallinau, closing our local library, a group of friends and I. So we told our parents, we heard that there was this meeting taking place and we were going to go attend, that they were going to talk about the closure, and even though the decision had pretty much been made, the community wanted a voice, and so they staged this meeting. And our parents said, yeah, sure, go ahead. It was nothing out of the ordinary, we were going to the library all the time. This was before the age of internet, yes? Like, before every computer had a home, so we went there for research. Went there to do our homework. We went there, actually, when we wanted to get away from our parents and someplace warm to hide. We'd go to the library. We went there because the librarians would help us with our homework. The librarians would help me with our science projects that we'd put together in our neighborhood. Help us with research. So when we heard they were closing the local library, we hopped on our bikes, and we pedaled down, and we went to the meeting, and we sat in the back, and we listened as all these adults spoke about the financial repercussions, and they talked about the community identity that would be affected, and, you know, these really intelligent, well-researched arguments, and they talked about the political underlying issues, and finally they said, anyone else have something to share? I put up my hand on behalf of our group, and I walked up to my front, and I got to the mic, and our argument wasn't quite as well-researched, or quite as, you know, deep with rhetoric and absolutely emotional appeal. Our argument went as follows. It can't close the library because the other ones are too far for us to bike to. And started talking of it from the perspective of a young person. Because they were looking at closing this library. They said it wasn't serving enough people to justify the cost. And we were saying, there's nowhere else for us to go. We're 11. Our parents work. We can't hop in a car and drive to the local library, even if it's only a 20-minute drive. For us, on a bike or by foot, this is our space. This is where we could go. And from that first taste of activism, started attending the community meetings that took place, seeing as people designed petitions and gave speeches and put up posters, and lobbied governments. And that was the first time I learned all of these things I never learned in school. Learned what does it mean to rally together as a community around something you believe in? What does it mean to make your voice heard? What does it mean to be part of the democratic process? And I'm proud to say now, 10 years later, you go back in Thornhill, you can still go visit the Gallinau Public Library Resource Center that's still open and standing for young people. Libraries changed my life in another way, too. The reason I first got involved in human rights, the reason I first got involved in social justice from this perspective, why I'm speaking here today of children around the world, was an article. It was an article that was, I know it's some, a little bit difficult to make out. If we can dim these lights ever so slightly, it'd be wonderful. A little bit hard to make out. But when I was 12, still in our neighborhood in Thornhill, one morning I was looking for the comics in the local paper. Encourage your children to read comics. Encourage the adults in your life to read comics too. We need more of a laugh, especially in the mornings. I was looking for the comics. And if any of you read the Toronto Star, there's that little box in the second hand you flip over. It's like the legend to find the sections. So flipped over looking for that. And there was this headline that made me stop and read, and it caught my attention. And I started reading this headline that read, "Battled child labor, boy 12, murdered." And I was 12. So that made me stop. That made me pay attention. And I started reading the story of this young boy in Pakistan, the picture you see here. Young boy named Iqbal Masih, and his family was so poor that when he was 4 years old, they took out something called a peshi debt. It's a loan where you pledge labor as collateral. So they pledged their child as collateral. And when they couldn't repay, he started working in a carpet factory. And if you could imagine, we see them in downtown Toronto all the time, those hand-knotted carpets. That's what he did, tying thousands and thousands of tiny knots every day, weaving these carpets that then would get sent all around the world. And he worked from when he was 4 years old till he was 10. When he was 10, he escaped. And he started traveling, started speaking all around the world, came to North America, Europe, started shining a light on this. And when he was 12, he returned home. He was just outside of his house, outside of Lahore, Pakistan. And as he was on his bike with his cousin, who was traveling in front, he was shot dead. And they never caught the person. They believed he was killed because he was speaking out against child labor. I was 12. He was 12. It was just looking at our lives. It was that simple. Looking at his life, looking at my life, seeing the two extremes in our world. And I remember feeling so angry that I literally just tore out this article out of the front page of this paper and shoved it in my backpack. And I went to my parents. And I went up to them and I said, "Mom, Dad, have you ever heard about child labor?" And they said, "Sure. Well, can you tell me about it?" Not much. And my dad's comment was, "That's why we bought one of those fancy encyclopedia sets for you to look at." And my mom said, No. Go to the library." Both teachers. That was their first reaction. Go to the library. And so I hopped on my bike, went down to Gallineau Public Library that was still open, and walked up to the librarian there and unfolded this crumpled up newspaper and put it on that little like reference desk and said, "I need your help. I need to find out more about this." She read the same article that same morning and she'd been equally disturbed and she said, "Sure." And so she walked me through the library as we started doing research. We started learning more about the historic aspects of the mills back in the United States. We started learning more about the international aspects. And she started helping me in this research project. And it's funny because I look back now in history. Free the Children has now grown as an organization. We've worked with 1 million children around the world. Every year we train 250,000 kids in North America through our leadership training camps and conferences. We have this massive infrastructure, this group that is the world's largest network of children helping children. And I look back to that moment, how we first started, and the people in our lives. And I've always wondered, if one of the pieces didn't fall into place in that same way, if we hadn't received that same support from our teachers, or from our parents, or from that librarian, who helped me to realize that it wasn't only one child, it wasn't only Iqbal, but instead to learn there are 250 million other children in the world just like him. If it weren't for those stories and that research and that knowledge, I wonder if I'd be standing here today. And I wonder if we would have impacted the lives of 1 million children around the world and the 250,000 kids every year in North America. And I still laugh when I think of that city council meeting where they argued they had to close the local library because it wasn't affecting enough people in the dollar ratio. I'd love to go back in history and say, tell you what, we affected 1 million children around the world. Would that be enough? The lesson, keep the local libraries open. That was when we first started. But from that initial support, an organization was born, started learning more about the realities of children around the world. Countries like Pakistan, children working in the brick kiln, children literally bought and sold as slaves. Or in the mines, South America, and children who dragged coal on their backs deep from underground. A lot of the kids are only like this tall, and they're fully grown. They've worked underground all those years. Parts of Africa. The photos from Sierra Leone, West Africa, went through a brutal civil war. Absolutely brutal. We work in that country. We rebuild schools. And when I had the chance to visit, I've been very fortunate. These countries, these pictures, I had the chance to visit a little over 40 countries where we do human rights work and to share with you these stories. When I had the chance to visit Sierra Leone, we started going village to village, and they were saying, we need schools, we need schools. And we asked them, why are all the schools destroyed? And they told us that during the fighting, there were 30,000 child soldiers, children who they recruited and forcibly put guns in their hands and told them to go fight. 30,000 child soldiers. And they would go to the schools. They would literally recruit straight from the classrooms. And this became so well known, the teachers started, and those who taught students, started to try to hide them. When they knew the rebels were coming, they would usher all the students out of the classrooms and they would hide them in the bushes so the rebels couldn't get to them, or even sometimes the government forces couldn't get to them. And so they started a campaign of terror where the rebels, the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front, when they entered a village, one of the first things they would do is line up all the teachers in front of the students and in front of the community members, and then they would execute them. And then they would burn the schools to the ground, or they would fill them with bullet holes. Because schools, education, literacy, it stood for everything they were fighting against. It stood for democracy. It stood for rights. It stood for women's empowerment. It stood for the backbone of a society where people come together in community buildings. Where they create resistance. In our travels, we saw another extreme. An extreme and a reason to give us hope. Photos also from Sierra Leone, from one of the villages where we work. And one of the gentlemen there, an older man from the Mafinder family, he told us his family name. And he was telling us about how the war affected him. And he told us he had 2 daughters and his wife. And when the war broke out, they started fleeing from their village. They were trying to get to a neighboring country for safety. And as they were fleeing, the rebels stopped them, and they divided the group. The parents ran, the children ran, there was a whole group with them. Everyone got divided up, and the parents made away, but not the 2 daughters. Susanna and Hannah, who were 9 and 6 at the time. And these 2 girls were taken to be domestic servants by one of the commanders in the army. And the father was telling me how every day he would cross back into Sierra Leone, across the border, and he would search in these villages, trying to find his 2 daughters. And how one day, finally, he got to the home of the rebel commander, the person who had his daughters, and he was pleading for their release. And the commander, impressed by his bravery, because they knew that if the father had been caught for what he was doing, the father would have been killed for crossing back into rebel-controlled lines. And he was impressed. And so he said to the father that he could have 1 daughter. And that the commander would keep the other. And the father told me, he asked him to choose. When the father was telling that story, he just completely broke down crying as he was telling this. And he held his hands up and he said, how do you choose which daughter goes free and which one stays a slave? Basically what they were, domestic servants, a slave. He said, I couldn't do it. He said, I was standing in front of the commander, and I was crying, and I was pleading, and the commander said I wasn't strong enough. And so he put his hands down on the two daughters and started to take them both away. When the eldest, Susanna, who was now 11 by that point, spoke up and said, I'll stay. She made the choice for her father. She said, I'll stay so my younger sister can go free. This is years later, when the war finally ended and they were reunited. But seeing in that moment that extraordinary courage and that extraordinary act of compassion that literally bought a person's life with your own. These are the type of stories we see that inspire us through our travel, working with street kids. There's a lot of street kids around the world. And yes, you hear the horrific stories, but they're pretty amazing. A lot of these street kids, they have to be to survive. We were in India, we were working with a group of street kids, and one of them, we were in the train stations, and one of the young boys there was crippled. He had no legs. And so his friends were picking him up, and they would carry him place to place so he'd never be left behind. In Thailand, we bring volunteer groups, so 20 young people, bring volunteer groups every year to developing countries, so 350 kids every year. We brought this volunteer group to Thailand, and one of our volunteers handed an orange. The street girl, she was sitting cross-legged, she was begging for food. It's the international sign where you cup your hand and you bring your hand to your mouth. It's a symbol of food. Handed her this orange, and she took it, and she peeled it, and she broke it apart, and you could tell she was hungry. She was so excited about this. And she was peeling it apart, and she was about to bite into it, and she stopped. And she got up, and she started walking through the street and breaking the orange in little pieces and handing it to all the other kids who were begging on the street. And then she sat back down at her place and she had her one piece. Also in Thailand, we bring groups to volunteer at a center for street kids there. It's an orphanage, mostly. Parents who, because of HIV/AIDS, children who the families were just too poor and they had to give up, they sent to the city, they sent to Bangkok to find jobs. And one day we had our volunteer group there, and we saw there was this big celebration that they were getting ready. They had this massive birthday cake, and they were icing it, and they wrote the words in Thai, happy birthday. And we asked the kids, you know, what's going on? And they said, we're having a celebration. We said, yeah, whose birthday is it? And they looked at us, all confused, and they said, well, it's everybody's birthday. And we said, yeah, but, I mean, today, whose birthday is it? And the kids were all just looking at each other like, the translation didn't work or something. They're like, it's everybody's birthday. And finally, the house mother explained to us that none of these kids knew when they were born. They didn't know their birthdays. They left their families so early. And so there's one day a year where the whole community, it's the most amazing thing. I know these photos are hard to make out because they're so far apart. But there's all the food, the whole community contributes in this giant potluck where all the kids get to celebrate and forget about the streets and forget about the hardships and just be kids. It's a photo of one of our volunteers who was literally dancing. The young boy who had AIDS, helping him dance on his birthday. No presents. Very little, but the most amazing smiles and the most amazing celebration, more incredible than you'd ever see in North America. I wanted to open to share with you these stories for a reason, to understand why we do the work that we do. Because for me, this is my issue. This is what I care about. I believe that everyone out there has an issue. You can be 12 years old. You could be 38 years old. You could be 99 years old. Someone asked me, do we only let young people get involved? And I said, Martha Graham once said, youth is but a state of mind. Everybody out there sees things in the world they want to change. And most often, you interact with those people. Just like that 12-year-old boy 10 years ago who walked into Gallino Public Library and uncrumpled a newspaper and put it on a desk and said, I need help with research, the librarian. People walk into your library on issues they're passionate about. Sometimes they hear something in the news or they see something on television, or maybe they were just walking down the street and they saw a homeless person and they want to learn more. Turn to you for help with research, a school project on an issue, whatever it might be. It's helping people, even us, but especially young people, but of any age, find their issue, find what they're passionate about. Helping a young person who walks into your library for a science fair project get excited about what they're researching and realize, you know what, if you're researching the ozone or if you're researching pollution, take it a step further, make a change on it. Helping young people find, because everybody out there has an issue, and I believe it, everybody out there of every age, it might be child poverty, the fact in Canada, 1 in 5 Canadian children, one of the wealthiest nations in the world, and 1 in 5 Canadian children live under the poverty line, or peace. We spend almost $1 trillion every year on the armaments, on military. That's U.S. Makes a difference. Youth violence and crime. Especially those of you librarians in certain communities. I went to school in Scarborough, for example. Massive issue. Gang violence. Racism. 250 million people still live under some form of racism today. Aboriginal rights. If you separate the Aboriginal population in Canada, we rank anywhere, we're always within the top 10, but anywhere from 3rd to 8th on the best countries in the world in which you live. If you separate the Aboriginal people in Canada, pretend they're their own nation and calculate it, they would rank 42nd in the world. That's the difference. An incredible fall. AIDS. You're going to hear Stephen Lewis talk later on about AIDS in Africa. 22 million people affected. Never mind the orphans and the fact that you can't get teachers in some of these communities and the impact. For those of you who do work with youth, just wanted to launch a challenge, 10 ways to help them find their issues, discussing news items with them, having them bring articles into class, making watching the news an assignment, running a challenge in the various homerooms of their school, having an NGO fair, just like a science fair, where they all set up little, you know, booths and they present an issue they're interested in, or inviting community organizations in, keeping a bulletin board where they can post volunteer placements, sharing a copy of the newspapers always there for them to read, having a hero, recognizing heroes, celebrating them, putting posters and filling the libraries with them to celebrate the good that's happening in the world, to inspire others with their words and their actions, inviting your MP or MPP to come in and speak, inviting a guest speaker. Just some ways. We have 101 on our website. That's just a small tidbit of how to help young people find their issue. And again, it's not only youth. I honestly believe everyone out there today has something they want to change in the world also. There was another reason why I opened with those stories, starting with your Thailand or Sierra Leone or other children all around the world. Those kids in Thailand, for me, they redefined how I do happiness. They redefined, whenever I go overseas, what I count my blessings. You know, people ask those who work in human rights, you know, especially those, and thankfully that's not the type of role that I have, but I meet people who literally spent their entire life in war zones and their entire life in slums and refugee camps and jails. And I always ask them, how do you do it? I find being there 2 months or 6 months incredibly emotionally challenging, never mind spending a decade, even longer. And they always tell me, you have to understand, when we come back home, everything looks different. When you open your fridge, you say a prayer, you count your blessings. When you see that there's a roof overhead at you at night, you smile. When you see your kids or your grandkids, when you see someone who loves you, you suddenly realize you are the luckiest person in the world. When you sit down with someone who in Sierra Leone literally lost their arms because they had a campaign of terror where they chopped off hands of those who voted, suddenly you never, ever take for granted your democratic responsibility and rights. When you talk to someone who slept on a heating grate in downtown Toronto last night at a volunteer center, you suddenly realize that the home we have, whether it be big or small, is extraordinary. When you talk to a child who hasn't eaten for 2 days and who's going through a garbage dump, you suddenly realize how fortunate we are to have a plate of food in front of us. We're blessed. We're lucky. We're fortunate. Whatever word we want to use, but so often we forget it. It's realizing that we have a lot, and that doesn't mean we should feel guilty or we should feel angry or we should feel frustrated, but instead that's a great thing. It's a tradition in every language, every culture, every faith group. They say that to those whom much is given, much is expected in return. We have a lot. That's a great thing. That means we have a lot to share. And I'm not only talking about dropping a few, you know, coins in someone's hat in downtown Toronto, but sharing who we are, sharing a smile, sharing our time, volunteering, sharing our voice, speaking out on an issue where we're protected, helping to share our gifts and our talents. And I think especially in this world, people don't realize how we all do have gifts and talents to share. Because we all have an issue, just like we all have something we want to change in this world. Child poverty, the environment, whatever it might be, I believe we all have a gift, something to make that change. It was a couple years ago. I was 19. And there was this other young person, he was 19. We were being interviewed on a television show. Some of you may remember the host, Pamela Wallin. She used to have a TV show. Well, Pamela Wallin was interviewing this 19-year-old, and by the age of 19, he had finished high school. Which, okay, not that impressive, but thought I'd just mention it. Finished university. I'm in university myself, so I was pretty impressed. You know, I look back in hindsight now. Finished his master's. He's 19. Yeah, that was my response, that kind of that little laugh. I was like, uh-oh. Finished his PhD. Yeah, I finally got you guys there. Okay. And now that's when you went, oh, okay. He was gifted. He said so himself. He was very gifted. He actually said his exact words were, he was off the charts gifted. He was very gifted in self-confidence too, but that's a whole other discussion. If you remember, and I know this is like, if you guys had kids yourself, you probably remember, but, or if you work in schools, grade 3, Ontario, we all take this gifted test. Yeah. You're working at school, obviously, and the fact that you're like, yeah, that quickly. We all do this gifted test. I can vaguely remember it. It's like you circle the blue box and not the red box. I always imagine, like, this guy with this white lab coat and frizzy hair and a giant computer and, like, woohoo, gifted, you know, like, putting them in piles, and then the next one comes out. Oh, no. The other pile. Okay, well, this guy, he was gifted. And he kept telling us, he actually was incredibly gifted. The score was so high that he was sent to a special school. And his parents kept telling him as he was growing up how he was gifted. And his teachers kept showering all this extra attention on him because he was the gifted student. And the media did all these articles. He was like 8 or something when he finished high school. And so they did all these articles saying Wunderkinder. And how he was gifted and gifted and gifted. And they kept using this word again and again and again. And of course, self-fulfilling prophecy here. He turned out to be extraordinarily gifted. And he kept telling us this. And if you remember how Pamela Wallin worked, she would kind of like fold her arms like this, and she would continue the interview to keep the conversation going by repeating the last word the guest said. So it went like this. He was like gifted, and she was like gifted. You're gifted. I got it. You're gifted. And finally, during this interview, she, oh man, yeah. She looked at me, I remember, and she was like, so, what about you? I was like, oh. I was just thinking to myself, I'm like, don't ask the question. Don't ask. She asked, what about me? You know, and she's like, you gifted? And I looked back and I said, no. I don't actually even think I said something that audible. I think I was like, nope. Later on the day, come back to our office. walk in the door, got teased by my friends, took my desk, and well, we have an office, you have to kind of understand, our office is filled with young people. More than half of our staff are recent university grads who intern because they teach a human rights program in schools that we run across Ontario and BC. So a lot of young people, an army of like, you walk in and there's like 40 young people sitting down at my desk, and we're a charity, so you know, small office, share it with the web design team. I'm typing away, trying to like focus, you know, think of my work, and couldn't. I kept thinking about this interview, thinking about this guy actually. And it kind of got on my nerves. And typing away, and lean back, and I look at our web designer. You know, our web designer makes a website that gets visited